Hello, educators and learners, and welcome to Homeroom with Sal, brought to you by Khan Academy. We're an educational technology nonprofit dedicated to bringing a world-class education to anyone, anywhere, and Sal is our founder. I'm not Sal Khan, I'm Kevin Dangor. I'm from the engineering team, and I'm here to introduce today's show. Since spring of 2020, Sal's been hosting a chat show on YouTube and Facebook Live called Homeroom with Sal, where he answers questions from our community and interviews notable folks from the world of education, technology, finance, entertainment, and more. We've taken some of our favorite conversations from that web show and turned them into a podcast. Without further ado, here's this week's podcast.
With that, I'm so excited to introduce Melinda Gates, author of Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World, and co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Melinda, great to see you.
Hi, Sal. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's so much that I could talk about, and you cover a lot of this in your book, and there's a lot of work that you've done beyond the book. Maybe a good place to start would be with the book. Why did you decide that now was a good time to write a book, and what are your hopes for it?
Well, I wrote this book and introduced it in 2019, and now we're coming out just now with the paperback. And I wrote it at the time because I had been lucky enough to travel the world because of the foundation, and I'd met so many women who had really animated my life and called me to action. And I felt if I could tell their stories, it might call the world to action. And when I wrote this book, I think we as a community thought we were on our way towards gender equality. And now here we are in the middle of a pandemic in early 2021, and women have really been set back in the United States and all over the globe. So we have a lot more work ahead of us.
And what's been surprising, you know, when I saw the book and I started reading it, I expected to hear a lot of the stories of your travels, the work that y'all have been doing with the foundation, and there's definitely that. But what's been really interesting, it's also a very personal book where you kind of thread in your own experience trying to balance the different pulls on your time from trying to be a great mother, trying to have a great career at the same time, and kind of relating that to, you know, a general theme of women around the world have all of these things that they're trying to balance.
Yes, I thought it was important to include my personal story. I mean, to begin with, you know, I do live a life of extreme privilege now, but growing up, I grew up in a very middle-class family in the United States. And I think no matter whether you're in a low-income country, middle-income, or high-income, women face a lot in their lives that we just don't talk about. And I thought it was important to talk about my own journey and my own struggles with balancing being a mom, which I absolutely wanted to be and am, and a working woman. And I tried to then highlight how that also is similar for so many women around the globe who don't even have the resources that I have to get some extra support and help.
So I want to go into actually both of those, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions of that. But first, when we're talking about helping women around the world, and obviously there's the pre-COVID context in which you wrote the book, and then what you're able to see both in the broader kind of, you could say, industrializing world and in the industrialized world, what COVID stresses are putting on. What do you see as, you know, if you want people to walk away with the handful of things that are the real challenges facing women that we really have to address, what are they to you?
They are, to me, the barriers that hold women back in society that we so often don't talk about, harassment and abuse, whether at home or in the workplace. The other big barrier, quite frankly, is this childcare work, this unpaid labor that women do in their homes every single day. No matter where you are in the world, women do more unpaid work than their husband or their spouse does. And that keeps them often from being fully in the workforce and being fully present. And then there are many things we can do to accelerate women in key industries, making sure we get money in their hands, accelerate them in finance, accelerate them in the tech sector in the United States, accelerate them in policy making and political positions. Because until you have women with a seat at the table using their full voice and decision-making authority, we will never have sound policies that benefit all of society. And those are imperatives for us if we're going to really move forward as a world.
You know, there's a lot in that. You know, there's a fairness argument, which is a very strong one. There's the argument you just made, which is this argument around you really need a diversity of viewpoints around the decision-making table, especially if it's going to affect people of different viewpoints. But, you know, in your book, you refer to, and this definitely struck a chord with me, you talk about the study in Bangladesh, which is where my family originally comes from, where they're able to actually, to some degree, run an experiment where women were more in the driver's seat of things like family planning, and what that led to. It didn't just lead to better outcomes for those women. If you could talk a little bit about that, because I think that's a super poignant example for why it's so important to invest in women.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Sal, because I think so often we don't talk about family planning or contraceptives. And yet, when you look in the United States, what has allowed women to go to college and to get a degree and to work in the workforce? It's being able to decide when, whether, and how often to have children. So in Bangladesh, as you referenced, in the 1970s, the longest global health study that's ever been run were two different sets of villages, where one set had full access to contraceptives. Women were educated about their bodies, all types of methods of contraceptives, and then they used them. And other villages that didn't have access. And what they found over this long study was that in the villages where contraceptives were readily available and used, the families were healthier, the children were healthier, the children were better educated, and the families overall were wealthier. And that's because the moms and dads could space the births of their children and feed and educate each one of them and start down that path to prosperity before they chose to have another child. And that it makes a profound difference in terms of unlocking the cycle of poverty for a woman and for her family.
Now, you talk about that. I mean, when you point it out, it's something we so take for granted. You mentioned in the book how you were able to essentially plan things out. It made me reflect on my wife and my journey where, you know, my wife also, you know, she's more educated than I am. She went to med school. And that for our first child, we kind of said, okay, there's that year right after residency before you start. Okay, let's have our first child then. And that ability, which we take for granted, is not something that's commonplace for most of human history. And unfortunately, in a lot part of the world, is still not expected. And so it's really when you're able to space it out, the family can have resources, they can invest in their children. And then obviously, I can imagine that has follow-on effects. Are there other, you know, it seems like that's one of the top things, just the ability to have control and be able to space things out and make sure that the resources. Are there other big things that you think folks should know about? And, you know, folks being everyone listening, people in government, people in the philanthropic sector that are high leverage points for empowering not just women, but because you're empowering them, the communities that they're part of.
Well, certainly two things I would say. Educating a girl. When a girl has access to school and to a good education, she makes completely different decisions about her life. And when she has access to those new ideas and that new thinking, she also delays usually when she gets married and when she has children. That, again, has a profound effect on a community, not just at a community level, but at a regional level and at a country level. And it's why finally, in the last 10 years, so many presidents and prime ministers actually finally show up at the UN and talk about girls' education, getting girls into school and keeping them all the way through at least secondary school. So that is a really important factor, is girls' education, just like boys. And the other one is getting economic means in a woman's hand. So all over the world, one of the things that we now have, of course, are phones. And even if you don't have a smartphone, but you have access to an old plastic phone, there are governments all over the world, India, Bangladesh, many others, Tanzania, Kenya, where they're making sure that women and men can save $1 a day, $2 a day on their phone. So they actually have a bank account so that when the school fees come due for the child or there's a health shock in the family or they need to purchase food, the woman has money of her own that is not her husband's money. And that is vitally important because it empowers her in the family. And she is often the one who decides who's going to eat first, second, and third, or who's going to go to the medical facility, or who's going to help pay for the tuition when it comes due at the school. So a woman, when she has money in her hands, she can get out of an abusive situation. She can invest in a small business. She can make different decisions for herself and her children. Money is power, and it makes a difference for women's own power and influence.
It makes a ton of sense. You know, at least a natural question, when I read some of the stats, the studies on these various dimensions, it seems like a no-brainer that more of the world should be focused on this, should be investing. And I know there's been a lot of progress over the last several decades, but it also makes me wonder, why weren't people already doing that? You know, the role of why haven't governments, why has there had to been such an emphasis on the philanthropic sector? And then maybe take the other side. You know, you in the book mentioned when you first met Hans Rosling, famous, you know, data visualizer, how you were skeptical. You know, I think he said something like, you know, American billionaires are going to mess things up. And you hear that more and more in the public narrative of people saying, well, philanthropy sounds good, but we're not so sure, or maybe this is too much power in the hands of a few people. Where do you see that balance? Where's the role of philanthropy? And what's your sense of, how you make people realize that there's actually a lot of value here?
So let me start with the second question, which is philanthropy's role. I think philanthropy does its best when it understands that it is part of an ecosystem. What you need is philanthropy, government, private sector, that is businesses, civil society, all working together to benefit the world and society. What can philanthropic money do that some of the others can't? They can take risks where there is no market, so a business won't enter it, or where the government doesn't want to take the risk with the citizens' money. It can try new things. It can further new ideas. And if those things prove out, then it's up to government to fund them and to spread those ideas. So to your question, though, the earlier one was, why was it a decade ago when, 15 years ago, I'd happened to be at the UN or other places with other global leaders? No one talked about girls, first of all. Girls were not on the agenda. Women were only on the agenda when it came to their maternal health. Prime ministers and presidents didn't talk about women and girls other than that. Well, why is that? It's because we run in a society where males run the top of society. They run the political bodies. They run quite often the social media platforms. They run the newspapers. And so you have to make sure that you actually make extra investments to help women rise up into those positions of power. Because if you don't have a diverse slate of people at the table, that is in our own country, people of color, women, and men, you then don't get a diverse representation of society. And so you make policy, government policy, based on what you know. But if that comes from, say, a group of just white men, they don't see the full view of society that a woman or a person of color with their lived experience would have seen. And thus, you don't build into society the places that will unlock opportunities for women and people of color. And that's why I am such a big proponent of making sure we create pathways for women into the key industries, such as politics or finance or tech, because of how pervasive and how much those areas run our society and our globe.
You know, and I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the question I asked, in full disclosure, many folks know, your foundation has been, one of kind of the founding sponsors of Khan Academy. So obviously I have some biases here that I should have a full disclaimer for, but Khan Academy would not exist without the philanthropic sector. And it absolutely, even when my friends were skeptical, why does Khan Academy even exist? Shouldn't it be for profit or shouldn't it be government? It's exactly in that zone where it needs to move fast and innovate, but it needs to operate on values that maybe market forces, which I'm normally a big fan of, might not lead to the outcomes we want. And that's just a small example. But some of the work that y'all have been doing with malaria, with polio, with diarrhea, some of these things that shouldn't be killing anyone for the last several decades were killing thousands or in some cases millions of people. I mean, both you and Bill, I think, are very humble about how many literally millions of lives you saved. and arguably it should be part of government, but without the philanthropic sector there, I don't think, you know, these aren't vanity projects. I don't think any of that would have mm-hmm. happened. You know, one question, a lot of questions coming in on social media. I'll get to some of them. I've been using my privilege to take all my questions. But this question, it's related to that last point. It's from YouTube, from Chillax. What do you think you have achieved by working and collaborating with women in different countries? And, you know, I do wonder that, you know, you and Bill, you go on a lot of these trips, you go on a lot of trips, you visit villages, you're really in places that many of us have never been to. You know, my family's from Bangladesh. I think you've gone into more of the real rural villages of Bangladesh than I or many members of my family have ever been to. What do you learn from those trips that you might not have appreciated before?
Well, I think it's fundamental to travel and to listen and to learn, because I think, you know, we could come in with our Western point of view of, oh, you need this for your child, or this is the way to do things because we do it that way in the US or Europe. When in fact, you listen to the locals, they have very good reasons for doing what they do. And they have seen more death and disability than we have. They can tell you what might work or what the barriers are that hold them back. You can come in, for instance, with the very best vaccine or new tool, let's say for malaria. But if the village elder who makes the decision won't let that tool be taken up, it's going to go nowhere. And so for women, what I have learned is that you need to go in, sit down with them in their homes and where they gather in the village market or on a local mat, talk with them and the men, eventually let the men wander away back to the fields or to their business. And then you hear the truth of women's lives and you hear what they're up against, what lengths they will go to, how they do take their meager means and feed their children. And you learn that women are incredibly resilient. And so one of the things I've been fortunate enough to be involved in or help lead is this effort on family planning, because so many women have told me, I've heard of those tools. We used to have them in my village. I don't have them now. And I have 6 children. I cannot have a 7th. I cannot feed these children. And so I've helped lead this family planning effort because there are 200 million women asking us for contraceptives, and we need to educate women about contraceptives and their bodies if they don't know about them. And if they do, make sure they have access to them so they can voluntarily decide if they want to use them and if and when to have children.
And where do you think this is going? I mean, you've talked about a lot of the good work that's already happened, but it also is kind of painting a picture. There's a lot of important work that needs to be done. What do you see for yourself, or I would say for the broader sector, what needs to be the priorities for the next 5 or 10 years? And what is an outcome we can be hopeful about in 10 years and maybe one that we should be afraid of if we don't take action?
Yes, well, I will have to be frank that this COVID-19 pandemic has set us back enormously in global health and global development. You know, where poverty was on the decline, we're now seeing poverty on the rise. Where we were making huge inroads on contraceptives, for instance, there are now going to be 15 million unintended pregnancies this year alone, we estimate, because of the lack of contraceptives. So the global health community will have a lot of building back to do to make sure that vaccination rates stay up, to make sure children are fed and kept alive. But some of the things we can be hopeful about, I think, do come from these new tools. The fact that so many people around the world have a cell phone in their hands, you know, information is power, money is power. We can give them life-saving information on their phone. We can start to hook them up in their local community with telemedicine, especially if the health services just aren't there or aren't functioning well, which is true in many countries around the world. And so I think these new digital tools give us opportunities. As long as we get them out equitably into women's hands, we teach women about the internet and we make sure that they have access. And so it means we have to do special programming just for women so that they do actually get these new tools. Or if there's a new seed available that's drought resistant or pest resistant against climate change, we have to go the extra mile to not just get it in the hands of men, but to get it in the hands of women too, so they can get a bigger yield and get more income off their farm. Because most women in the world, their work is in the informal sector and they're farmers.
And I mean, you touched on that in that last statement. You know, what do you see as the role? Obviously, there's a role for policymakers, there's a role for philanthropy. There's a huge role for women, obviously, in this. What do you see as, how do we change the culture or what's going on in the men's minds? And, you know, I'm curious about a lot of places we've been talking about where even things like family planning, you can't take for granted. But then after that, I have a few questions about, you know, how do we do it in a lot of our lives as well?
Well, I think to change culture, you really have to start where people are. And you have to listen to them about why they have certain beliefs, why they do things the way they do them. And only over time, with a lot of trust and discussion, can you start to introduce new ideas. And then people have to decide for themselves, do they want to take up those new ideas? Yes, you can push down with top-down policy, for instance, a good child marriage law, but communities have to accept that and decide they're not going to do child marriage again. Even in the United States, things like that used to be acceptable before in my mom's generation, we don't say those are the norms today. And so we spread things and ideas through our networks, and then we influence one another. So for instance, today, you'd be pretty hard pressed to find too many women smoking during pregnancy. And yet when Jackie Kennedy was the first lady of the United States, there's pictures of her smoking. Well, we became to learn that is not good for babies or moms. But those ideas, there had to be good policy, but we had to have good ideas spread. That's how you spread new ideas in all kinds of communities about issues for women, about breaking down men's thinking about what women's roles can or should be. And even for us about what ideas we have about people of color in our own country or indigenous people. That's how you change hearts and minds. And it takes time, but it can be done.
No, and on that, you know, you've touched on this in your own personal life, and actually I wanted some help with mine as well. You talk about this notion, which is absolutely true, and we started there, that in it, whether we're talking about a village in Bangladesh or we're talking about, you know, a two-income professional family in Seattle or Silicon Valley, some of this issue of, you know, women are disproportionately doing a lot of what has to happen in the house and at home, even when someone hypothetically is a rheumatologist. My wife's a rheumatologist. And, you know, my question is, and it's true, my wife's a rheumatologist. I obviously, you know, spend my time working on Khan Academy. You know, in theory, I would love for there not to be this bias or this uneven playing field. But my wife, you know, we never argue. I hear some parent families argue about things like how much, who does what? You know, one thing that I've thought about, do we just have unrealistic expectations on both men and women that essentially, you know, we want to be super parents, which could take 90% of your time. We want to be super workers, which take 90% of your time. And so if you have two people, each three jobs that take 90%, you're trying to have, you know, 270% with only 200% of time. I'm curious how you and Bill have navigated that.
Well, I think in all of our homes, we have to look at who does what, and we have to say, what are our values and what do we want as a family and a society? And I think sometimes in the United States, we've gotten it a bit wrong where we value, you know, work so much as opposed to saying, wait a minute, in our homes, we all know we care about our families, but how do we balance society to make sure there are good childcare options out there, a good childcare infrastructure? How do we make sure in our homes we have the tough conversations about why do we both men and women, myself included, have gender normative ideas about who takes out the garbage or who does the dishes or who gets to go to their computer first after dinner versus helping the kids with homework? We have to actually look at all those tasks and say, how do we redistribute them? And are there times in each of our careers where maybe the woman's career goes first for a while and the man helps take care of the kids a bit more at home? And maybe then there's a time where his career goes forward and she takes care of the kids more at home. There are ways to blend and balance this. But we do need better policy making in the United States. We need a paid family medical leave policy. We're the only industrialized nation that doesn't have one. Only 20% of our workers get maternity leave. That's insane. And so we need to have good policy and we need to have honest conversations in our homes if we're going to change things.
No, couldn't agree more. And I could talk for hours about this because I think it's a fascinating subject, actually, you know, whether it's in the village or in the city. You know, in the time we have left, Melinda, any, you know, parting thoughts? And I actually say, you know, especially to those who've been watching, you know, we have students watching, we have parents, we have people of all ages. But, you know, I also think about it, especially to the men, you know, not to even view some of these things, we call them chores because, you know, there might be chores at home, but like to actually, to your point, embrace some of these things. Some of my best moments that I'll never regret in my life are when I am able to help with, you know, give my kids a bath. They're a little older now, so that'd be awkward. But when I was able to give them a bath or clean the house or whatever else, you know, what messages would you want everyone to take away, both from your book or just in general?
I would say, you know, we need to look at all of our norms in society. Whether I've met people in, you know, a remote village in Senegal, I've had men tell me, like, who have taken on more chores or made some changes, normative changes in their family. And I'll eventually get them alone. I'll say, well, why did you do that? And they said, because that work is hard that my wife was doing. My wife was tired. When she's happier, I'm happier and my whole family is happier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the U.S., we kind of have a saying, happy wife, happy life. I think it's true. If men and women are happier in their homes, our children are happier and more balanced, and we can go out and do what we want to do. So what I want to say to people is it's possible. We just have to really relook at things and decide what is it that we want. And what I know is that society is going to be better off when we have women taking their equal place to men, not just in their homes, but at all places that decisions are made. And we all need to work towards equality. In the United States, we're 208 years away from equality. We sometimes think, oh, we're 50 or 60. No, we're 208 years away. So we have to make these decisions in our home if they're going to have ripple effects in our community and in our world. And I know it's possible. You sounds like you're doing it and thinking about it in your own home, Sal. And that's fabulous.
No, it's we talk about it a lot. So it's a real thing, but you know, it's inspiring and it's good to know that, you know, in some ways it's comforting to know that you and Bill deal with some of the same problems that we're trying to, some of the same tensions. But, you know, I could talk for hours about this, and your book, which is incredible. I really encourage people to take a look. It's out in paperback today, where, you know, it talks about, I mean, just a lot of really interesting things I think everyone needs to be informed about, men and women. Melinda, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the years of support for what we're doing at Khan Academy and frankly, changing the lives of millions around the world and setting an example with things like the Giving Pledge of kind of, I think, a new generation, a new type of philanthropy that I think is changing the world. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on your homeroom. I wish you'd been in my homeroom when I was growing up. All the best to you.
See you. Thank you so much.
If you want to hear more conversations with Sal, subscribe to this podcast and tell a friend. If you want to support the work we do here at Khan Academy, visit khanacademy.org/donate. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate your financial support in making sure that our materials can reach as many learners as possible, especially during this moment of COVID lockdowns. That's khanacademy.org/donate. That's our podcast, folks. Your host is Sal Khan. This show is produced by my wonderful Khan Academy co-workers, Stephanie Yamkovenko, Dan Tu, Irene Wang, Jenna Herzog, Anthony Nelson, Felipe Escamilla, Irene Chen, Ken Jones, Fail Lundberg, David Reinstrom, and me, Kevin Dangor. Our intro theme is Time Flux by Revolution Void. Our outro theme is Onward by Poddington Bear.